and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the comic artist and podcaster, Clay McCormack. Clay, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm going to be honest with you right from the start. This is going to be very cathartic for me, and I'll tell you why once you explain what we're covering.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it because this is a case where I am firmly on your side in the case of this being unjust and maligned. So please tell us what you've come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around its release, its reception upon release, why it is maligned, and then, of course, why you think that that is wrong.
Well, today we're going to be covering the 1989 version of The Punisher, starring international superstar Dolph Lundgren. And the reason that I'm going to find this very, so cathartic is before I actually came across your podcast, which I love, I was looking for another idea of a podcast to do myself, and I came up with a concept very similar to yours, being completely unaware of yours at the time.
Sure.
And the entire reason, I think, was so I could defend this movie. So this is checking a big box for me.
Oh, that's not dissimilar to my own motives for starting this show, so don't worry about that.
Anyway, it was made in 1989. It's actually Marvel's first attempt at a feature-length movie. But it was actually not released anywhere until, I think, 1990 or 1991, because the company that produced it, New World Pictures, which owned Marvel as a whole at the time, was bought out by another company. And when it finally was released, it was released straight to video because this purchasing company was actually not interested in theatrical releases for some reason. So it was sent right to video, and it was actually released in theaters everywhere else in the world except for the United States, Sweden, and South Africa.
Well, right, because I was going to say, I did see this in the cinema when it was theatrically released. I didn't realize it hadn't had a release in the States.
Yeah. No, this one kind of flew under the radar for a long time. And I've known this movie since I was a kid, you know, being a lifelong comics fan. And I've also only known nothing but scorn for it. So I'm definitely looking forward to talking about it. It was made at a bad time for Marvel to be dipping their toe into the superhero water, because 89 was the year that the first Batman movie came out, or maybe that's why they made it, I'm not sure. But if you watch it, you can kind of see a lot of 89 Batman in there, I think. I don't know if that's completely coincidental or if they were taking cues from that, as you know, seeing things that worked and what didn't work. But generally its reception has been overall negative. I think it's starting to come back a little bit when you talk to people about it, especially in light of the subsequent efforts to make a Punisher movie, which I don't know if that's just people trying to be hip by saying they like the Dolph Lundgren one better than the Thomas Jane version or whatever. But it's generally hated, and honestly, to this point, I've never been able to figure out a real reason, aside from the fact that he's not wearing the skull on his shirt like the Punisher does in the comics. That seems to be, as I'm looking up reasons why people don't like this movie, it seems to be the one constant, and aside from that, people are just like, it just kind of stinks. But that's the one thing. That's the one thing where people will be like, oh, he's not wearing the skull. How can you have the Punisher without wearing the skull? And the movie kind of stinks. But that seems to be about it.
It is such a, I've seen that myself, and it is such a weird reaction. Even when it was released, I remember saying, well, why doesn't he put the skull on at any point? It's like, really? You know, is that all that matters to you?
Right.
I think those later movies, the Thomas Jane movies, if anything, have shown it's tough to do a Punisher movie. He's a hard character to put on the screen, partly because he's kind of very unsympathetic.
Right.
You know, he's not a nice guy. Okay, he's killing even less nice guys, but nevertheless, he's not a sympathetic character. And that's one of the things I actually like about this version, is that it makes no real attempt to make him a nice and sympathetic character. It is kind of, you know, you look at it now with all the sort of the production design and the special effects from the late 80s, and it was a fairly low budget movie to start with.
Oh, definitely,
and
yeah.
So, yeah, it can, you know, it does look a bit cheesy. It has that air of late 80s low-budget action movie about it. But, I don't know, to me it has a certain charm. And part of that, I think, is that it doesn't treat it like a superhero movie. Like, I loved that first Batman movie. The first Burton Batman movie I thought was great. But I also loved this because it's a very different film and it doesn't attempt to sort of try and make him into a hero.
Come on, God. Answer me. If years I'm asking you why. Why are the innocent dead and the guilty alive? Where is justice? Where is punishment? Or have you already answered? Have you already said to the world, here is justice, here is punishment, here in me?
Oh, definitely not. And to speak to your point about it being difficult to make a Punisher movie, it's very deceptively difficult, I think, because he seems like such a simple character. Oh, he's just a guy who's out for revenge and he's got a bunch of guns and he kills people. It should be a slam dunk. But for some reason, it's just very difficult to do. And if anything, the skull shirt, I think, is, you see in later movies how difficult that is to work into the story and not have it come off really, really, you know, silly. In the Thomas Jane version, it's like he gets it from a T-shirt that his son gave him for his birthday or something, and it doesn't really make much sense. In Punisher Warzone, I think he just has it on all the time, so they don't really even need to address it. But even in Daredevil Season 2, the acquisition of the skull and the shirt is still kind of, I don't know, it's fine. I don't mind it that much, but it's still kind of dodgy in terms of how they managed to work it in. I think the other thing that I see a lot of people criticize it for, and I think it's along the same lines as the skull shirt thing, is they say, oh, it's a terrible adaptation of the comics. And I didn't read a ton of Punisher comics when I was growing up. But from what I understand, this movie seems to have all the elements of a Punisher comic. It's got Yakuza, it's got ninjas, it's got mafia, and it has a comic book level understanding of all of those concepts. So it seems to work. I think all of the elements are there, really.
Yeah, the only thing that stands out that's really sort of, you know, a big change from the comics is making him a cop rather than, you know, and that's why he's targeted by the mob. But, you know, big deal. I mean, that's dealt with so perfunctorily anyway.
Oh, definitely.
You know, that it kind of doesn't matter that much. And yeah, otherwise, I agree. I think this is actually a fairly faithful rendition of the comic, the original comic version of The Punisher before the sort of Marvel Knights and Marvel Max relaunch. The only difference is that obviously he doesn't occupy a world populated by superheroes, so he's not going to run into Spider-Man, for example.
Right. Yeah, and I think the movie's better for that. And, you know, as you were saying before, it's got a certain grittiness to it that I think this is really almost an ideal Punisher movie, because the Punisher, the character, is born out of as a response to movies like Death Wish and other 70s revenge movies of the same kind of thing, with a little bit of Rambo thrown in there for good measure, even though I think he probably predates Rambo, but anyway. And this movie is a low-budget 80s action movie that, you know, you can feel the low budget on the screen,
oh, yeah.
But it doesn't but it doesn't feel, you know, a lot of those movies you can along with the budget you can see in the screen, you can also see how they only had like two stunt guys who kind of knew what they were doing and, you know, one pyrotechnics guy who kind of knew what he was doing. So you can see a lot of the cheapness there. But the fights in this movie are brutal. And one of the reasons it is that way is because the producer actually was also the producer on, I think he wrote Karate Kid as well as a bunch of other movies later. He's a fairly prolific writer, and he wrote Taken, and he wrote a lot of Luc Besson's later movies, The Fifth Element and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things he actually did is when he hired Dolph Lundgren, who is, you know, a karate champion or martial arts champion, he also hired for most of the stuntmen other actual martial artists. So this is from the production notes in the DVD. I don't know if there's any way to confirm this, but according to the production notes, the fight scenes are not choreographed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's just two martial artists, or possibly multiple, depending on what scene you're in, just fighting each other, which, especially in the later scene when the Punisher is fighting those two guys in samurai armor, I feel like you can really feel that, because a lot of the hits and the kicks feel like they're really landing. And I think that really adds to the whole gritty vibe of this movie that just makes it work for me.
Wow. So they're just sparring, effectively.
Yeah, basically. I mean, again, I don't know if there's any way to confirm that, but that's what they say in the production notes.
That's crazy. I mean, for some scenes, I could believe it. There are others, like is it the fairground where that ninja has the chain?
Yeah.
With,
yep.
You know, that kind of, you don't mess around with chains.
Right.
I can't imagine that wasn't choreographed. But some of the scenes, you're right, I could believe it. That's crazy. And for people who don't know, Dolph Lundgren, he's almost kind of forgotten now, but there was a time when he was seen as kind of the successor to Arnie in terms of being a huge global action movie star.
Right.
You know, and obviously that never took off for one reason or another. But what a lot of people don't realize about him because of that is that, A, he's enormously intelligent. I think he's got like PhDs and stuff. He lived in Japan for several years, I believe. Studying, you know, working and studying martial arts and stuff. He's a genuine martial arts champion.
Right.
You know, he's the real deal. And yet, for some reason, he never took off in the same way that guys like Arnie and even Jean-Claude Van Damme did. But it's one reason why I always thought that he was great for this movie. He also looks really good in a black wig. Really suits him, even though he's a very blonde Nordic kind of guy.
Right.
Yeah, I saw this, as I said, when it was released in the theaters, it was my local town had, before the days of big multiplexes, had a cinema that had three screens. And what it actually had was one big screen and then two tiny little sort of screens that seated about 50 people. And it felt like you were watching it in somebody's front room with the TV set very far away, you know.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And we all kind of snuck in. Because I believe it was 18 rated or whatever the equivalent would have been then. And we were all 17. So we did kind of sneak in. And it was me, I think maybe like two or three of my old schoolmates. And there were two big, long-haired, leather-clad bikers down the front. We were at the back, they were down the front. And that's it.
That's the target audience right there.
Right. But that was the entire audience for this showing of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, I don't recall, you know, exactly what day we went to see it, but you would have expected more. It was definitely the opening week. You know, it's not like it was 3 weeks into the run or something, because I think it was only on at that theater for 1 week. And then, you know, clearly not enough people went to see it, so they took it off.
Right.
But it did kind of feel like a really good place to see it. It was kind of, you know, a bit crappy, the theater. Yeah, not many people there caring enough to go and see it. But we all had a really good time, you know, those of us who were there. And yeah, I don't know. I came out really enjoying it for all the reasons that I just gave. I also really liked the idea that he'd basically been driven mad with grief.
The whole
meditating naked in the sewers and stuff like that just seemed kind of perfect for the character. And this was before deconstructing comic heroes really became a widespread thing. Not to say that it hadn't been done up until that point, but it was before it became a really widespread phenomenon, and especially in movie adaptations. So it was kind of ahead of its time in that way.
Yeah, and I think I'm a little bit jealous, because I feel like you saw this movie under ideal circumstances. because, you know, going back to talking about the movies that had come before it, like Batman and Superman, comic book movies, as few of them as there were, tended to be big budget, glossy affairs, as dark and as, you know, gritty as you could say the 89 Batman is. It's a very big budget movie. This is a movie that you accidentally watch on 42nd Street, you know, when you've got nothing else to see. You know,
right.
this is a grindhouse movie. This isn't modern Marvel.
Yes.
This is the kind of thing that, I mean, I was actually watching the trailer last night after I finished the movie, and I was thinking, I was like, man, if this wasn't based on a comic, this would be like a perfect Grindhouse movie because it's so weird. Like, just the name, The Punisher, is a really schlocky name. And, you know, the trailer is done in that very sort of 80s action movie. He's here and he's to take revenge, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
With, you know, with shots of people getting, you know, blown off buildings and, you know, throwing stars in the face and all that good stuff. And it just, it feels right at home in that pocket. And it's, I think it's really easy to not appreciate what they actually made. And let's be honest here. This is probably the most academic anyone will ever talk about this movie.
Possibly.
But for me, to get into what the movie's about, the thing that really stood out to me, you know, as I said, I've been watching this for years, and I always enjoyed it because as a kid, there were no other superhero movies. It was Superman and Batman, and that was it. So anything with a comic book affiliation, I just jumped on. And I liked this for what it was, but it wasn't until years later that I watched it again and realized that the story they're actually telling is really good and really interesting in the stuff that it deals with and the way that they approach it. Like you mentioned the deconstruction of the character and these underground sequences where he's basically just meditating on the state of being and why is he there? His family's been killed and he wants justice, but has justice been brought to the world? Is he that justice? And it's really
right. Is he God's instrument of will?
Right. He's an insane person.
Yeah.
and on top of that, the actual story that they're telling is about consequences. And as someone who writes myself, that's the stuff that I really tap into is. The thing that makes really good stories for me are consequences to the actions that are taken, not just the actions themselves. And I feel like in a lot of modern stuff, you don't have that. So a lot of television shows just are sort of written like television shows where you have interactions with characters that seem like they need to be there because they were put on a whiteboard. But they don't really deal with the consequences of their actions. And this movie is entirely about the consequences of Frank Castle's actions as the Punisher.
Right, well, and about Jerome Cab's character, what's he, Franco, about the consequences of his actions as well, of course. And you're right. And one of the things that I like about this movie is that it does approach things with a certain amount of kind of common sense. Mm. I mean, yeah, the premise is absurd. But we know that, you know. But if you take that, you know, I'm of the opinion that you get one crazy thing that you can ask your audience to swallow in fiction like this. There's one crazy leap that you can ask them to make, and then after that, you're on your own. And the crazy leap here, of course, is that, you know, he would survive the bomb and become this awesome killing machine and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, take that as read. The approach to the situations that arise out of that is often quite naturalistic and even kind of humanistic. I mean, there's that bit with the torture rack. Which is, that is very Bond villain, I expect you to die. And that's kind of terrible. But apart from that, Tanaka acts like a ruthless gangster.
Right.
The cops do not act like idiots. And then you get that scene, and this is quite far into the movie, I know, but you get that scene with Louis Gossett Jr.'s character when they capture Frank Castle in the cell.
Yeah.
You know, when he's in custody. And he's just staring at him going like, what the hell happened to you? You're sick. Do you realize that? You're insane. And that's kind of realistic and very human.
What the hell happened, Frank?
Frank is dead. All right?
Oh, I see. So you decided everybody else had to be dead too, is that it?
No. If you're guilty, you're dead.
Courts decide who's guilty, not cops. I hereby swear to uphold the law. Remember, I've been looking for you for 5 years, man. Why the hell didn't you come to me for help?
I didn't need your help.
You're sick, you know that, don't you?
Right, right. And that scene is, I think, what really hooked me when I watched it later, because that scene's, that's a legitimately really great scene.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, say what you want about Dolph Lundgren's acting ability. In that scene, he brings what he needs to bring. And Louis Gossett Jr., I think this whole movie works only because Louis Gossett Jr. makes it work.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's the best actor on the screen. There's no question of that.
Right. And in that one scene, that's the scene where you really need to pay off all of the character points you've brought up to this point, the relationship between Louis Gossett Jr. and Dolph Lundgren's characters, which to this point they haven't been on screen at the same time. So you have to really buy it, and I think they nail it.
Yeah, I agree. As I say, I think that's a great scene. And, you know, yes, Louis Gossett is clearly the best thing in the movie. Mm. But I don't think there are any really bad performances. Jerome Crabb is great.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He's a very seasoned veteran European actor. Lundgren, yeah, you know, Lundgren is not Laurence Olivier, but as you say, he brings what he needs to bring to the role. He's not terrible. And then, yeah, the woman who plays Tanaka is great. Mm-hmm. I can't remember her name, but the woman who plays the cop.
Oh, right. Who's
kind of barely in it. Nancy Everhard, that's it.
Yes, that's it.
Yep. I mean, she's kind of the point. What is even the point of her character? It's a bit weird, her even being there, to be honest, because she doesn't do a lot, and then she gets kind of forgotten about at the end.
Right, right.
But they're all good performances. Even the kids, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Even the kids are not bad. They're not, again, they're not great. You know, this isn't Haley Joel Osment in AI or something, you know, but they're okay. They're not, they don't make you cringe.
Right.
It's just, it's kind of a shame that the production design is, and the budget is so poor, because you kind of get the feeling that if they just had a couple more million dollars, you know, to sort of make it look better and put right. the same performances into better scenes, better sets and what have you, maybe this would have gone down an awful lot better. Maybe it would have had a bit more success.
Yeah, I think so. Cause yeah, once you really get past that stuff, like you said, everything in it is pretty solid. I don't know if you could go back and read this script and kind of cringe at the script at all. But the stuff, even if that is the case, the actors in it pull it off.
Right.
And I think that's the most important thing. Like, we had chatted a little bit about a work print version that was floating around, which actually has a whole 15-minute intro that got cut out of the film that shows you in the actual movie. There's a when Nancy Everhard's character is introduced, she refers to this other drug bust where she played the prostitute. And this 15-minute opening is that whole drug bust. And you get to see those characters before the events of the movie. So you see the Punisher as just Frank Castle and his relationship with Louis Gossett Jr. and all of Frank Castle's home life. And it's basically a step-by-step thing leading from this one drug bust into the killing of Frank Castle's family. And I'll be honest with you, it does not help the movie out at all. It's I don't know if it's because it was written by someone else. I believe it was written later on by the producer to flesh it out. But it really – I don't know if it's – it's the kind of thing where as good as Louis Gossett Jr. is, what he's actually saying isn't coming across. It's not working.
Yeah, the whole sort of – you know, it's trying to set up that buddy relationship between
exactly.
them. But it's yeah. kind of dull. To be perfectly
oh,
honest,
yeah.
you know,
it's real dull.
There's a couple of short action bits in it, but it's mostly dull. And the important stuff, which is, you know, Castle's family being killed by the mob, you see that in flashback anyway during one of those sewer sequences when he's kind of, you know, having visions, which I always thought was fine. I never felt like I was missing anything by, you know, not seeing more scenes containing his family, because it's like, yeah. He loved his family. The mob killed his family. Now he wants revenge. I mean, really, you know, for a movie like this, what more do you need to know?
What the fuck do you call 125 murders in 5 years? Huh?
Work in progress.
Yeah, and you know, that's something else that's always been interesting to me is, you know, this is not an origin story. Aside from that, you know, I'm sure that's probably one of the reasons they cut that beginning piece, is because you don't need it.
Right.
And, you know, whereas most comic book movies are a step-by-step, you know, walkthrough of how the superhero came to be and how he got his powers and where he got his costume and all that kind of stuff, you don't need that.
I think you really don't need it with this character as well, especially because, as you say, you know, the Punisher himself grew out of that kind of the revenge fantasy movies like Death Wish and Dirty Harry and stuff. And you just, you know, we're all so familiar with those movies and with this genre that you really don't need to spend a lot of time setting it up. Just lay out the premise for the audience and we go, oh, okay, it's one of those movies. Fine, okay, get on to the shooting.
Well, I think I've always thought there's actually two ways you can approach characters like this. You can approach it like this, where you just kind of get the cursory set up and then you just kind of let it do its thing. But I think there's another way where you can spend the time and you can build it up. Like up until the newest iteration of the Punisher on Daredevil, which I think is fantastic, I always thought the best Punisher movie, you know, off, you know, quote unquote Punisher movie, was Denzel Washington's Man on Fire.
Oh, that's a great movie, yeah.
Because it's about, I think it's a little over 2 hours long, and they spend the entire first hour just driving home this relationship between Denzel Washington and the girl that he's supposed to protect. You know, and you see him go from a guy who doesn't care into someone who, you know, cares deeply for and loves this little girl. So when she gets taken, you know it's about to hit the fan. And you're waiting for that revenge bit to kick in, and it's going to be, you know, epic. This, on the other hand, and that movie is about that revenge, and it's about that relationship. The Punisher, this version of the Punisher, is not about that, so you don't need that. This is all about what happens as a result of that violence,
right?
And it doesn't hinge on what the catalyst for the creation of the character is. It's all about his actions and the results of his actions and how his actions, which are purely selfish, and under the umbrella of good intent to, you know, stop violence from befalling innocent people, eventually causes more violence to befall innocent people.
Well, yeah, you're right. And I think one of the things, as I mentioned, is that it's his family. So you can get away to a certain extent with saying, well, it's his family, so you don't need to establish that he loves his family. You know, right. Everybody kind of takes that as read, whereas with Man on Fire, that wasn't the case, obviously. But also, you're right, it was a very different approach. And it was, Man on Fire was a case where they just went all in. And as you say, it was almost the whole movie, apart from the sort of outburst of violence at the end, was about that relationship and sort of examining what it would take to bring this sort of revenge about in a man. Whereas, yes, this is not that. This is about the revenge itself. So, but I think you're right that you need to either be really perfunctory with it or kind of, yeah, go all in and say, okay, we're going to actually make that. That's what the movie is about.
Right, right. And just to sort of sum up the plot thread that really hooked me and why I like it, the main plot of this movie is that the Punisher has been existing and working and killing mobsters for 5 years. He's killed over 100 people, and he has weakened the mafia of, I don't know if they ever actually say New York, but I think
it's
supposed to be New York.
I'm not sure if they do, but they make enough offhand references that I think you are meant to assume it's New York, even though it was filmed in Australia.
Right, right. It doesn't totally pass.
No. No, some of the backdrops are distinctly lacking in skyscrapers.
Yes. Even though they do have the fight scene on quote unquote Coney Island, which I did find out is there is a, or at least was a place, an amusement park that had a Coney Island room or something like that. So that building actually existed.
Oh, wow.
And I'm sure that's how they covered themselves by saying, oh, well, this says Coney Island on it, so that'll be fine. Anyway, so he's killed so many mobsters that and weakened the mafia to such an extent that the Yakuza sweeps in and takes over their business and wipes out the rest of the mafia. But in doing that, one of the ways in the process of doing that, they also kidnap the children of all the mafia heads and are going to sell them into slavery. And at first, when the Punisher finds this out, he's like, okay, that's great. They're doing my work for me. They're just going to kill each other now. I can take a break. But then he's informed in rhyming couplet by his drunken pal, who seems to know everything for some reason, that they the kids have been taken, and that he can't just sit around and let these kids be killed or sold their innocence. And that's the linchpin for the character, because who are the people that were killed in his family? It was his kids, his two or three kids. And so that's clearly a sore spot for him. And so then he, you know, but in going and freeing these children, he saves the kids. It exposes him, which, you know, causes him to get arrested. And then he is forced to work with the mob boss that killed his family in order to save the mob boss's kid, which is an awesome, I don't know if it's cliche or not, but it's just, that's such a great, the way they get to that point and the execution of that plot point has always been really satisfying to me, because that's, I find that to be a really interesting character thing.
Right, and it does, it also sort of, again, kind of buries into the idea that he has sort of gone mad with grief, but that there is a humanity underneath there that you can sort of get at if you, you know, dig deeply enough and are tenacious enough, which I liked. I thought that was a good aspect of the character. And yeah, it's Franco, Jerome Crabb's character, it does a prison break essentially during the transport,
mm-hmm.
you know, prison transport break. And that is the last time that we see Nancy Everhard's character.
Yes. Yeah.
She fails to prevent the prison break and then we never see her again.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know whether that would count as a cliche or not, but it's a lovely twist and it sets up the ending very well, and the sort of showdown between, the triple showdown, if you like, between him and Franco and Tanaka is set up beautifully. And you mentioned his drunken pal, and that is the guy Shake, the out-of-work yep. drunken actor, mm-hmm. played by Barry Otto.
Excuse me, kind sir, but I can't help but see in you a man far luckier than me. What? Whatever you can spare will be sufficient, I think, to stand this old thespian a very stiff drink.
The hell's a thespian?
An actor, sir.
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
Hey, what'd I tell you about bugging the customers? Richie. Throw this trash out of here.
You can't take me like this. It's a lousy bad plan. I demand get respect. Up. I'm not trash. I'm a man.
Maybe I should have tried some Eugene O'Neill.
He really stuck with me because I saw this again before the days of, you know, DVDs coming out 3 weeks after a movie left the theatres. So I saw it at the cinema, and then I think I only saw it maybe twice again after that, and that was once on VHS at a friend's house and once when it was on late night TV. But the thing, so when I watched it again for this preparation for this show, a lot of it sort of like, oh yeah, I'd forgotten about that bit. Oh yeah, I'd forgotten about that. But the things I remembered, there were several. Things like the throwing star earrings and the fairground fight and mm-hmm. meditating naked in the sewers. But the main thing I remembered was Shake. What a great, memorable character. And I don't think he's based on any character from the comics.
Not that I know of. I know at the time the Punisher had a compatriot, I guess, named Micro or Microchip, who was kind of the guy.
Oh, but he was a hacker, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he got, you know, he was the guy that gave him, you know, all of his weapons and got him information, all that kind of stuff.
Right, a gadget and tech guy.
Yeah, but no, as far as I know, this character is completely original. And man, again, talking about an actor totally pulling off the dodgy stuff they have to work with.
Yeah, bad lines and sort of, I mean, he's only in three scenes, I think.
Everything he says is a rhyming couplet.
Because he's an actor, or rather, yeah. a thespian.
Right. And there's no reason why that should work, but he's just pulls it off really well.
And what about the children?
What children?
The children of the new bosses are now counted among their losses. They're being held for ransom by the Japanese.
So the bosses will have to pay up.
Pay they will, and all for naught. The children will be sold by the slave trade that they bought. My God, man, don't you see? This is a result of your five-year killing spree. You weakened the fathers to such degrees they couldn't protect their own families.
I punish the guilty.
And as a result, the innocent now suffer.
Yeah, he's great. And just the kind of fatalist sort of, you know, hangdog expression on his face and in his voice when he delivers some of those lines as well. He always stuck in my mind. I was like, what a great character who's only on screen for maybe 4 minutes out of the entire movie, but yeah, he steals it.
Definitely, definitely. And I think he's part of something that's you have to kind of get through. I understand why this movie might come off as laughable to people, because you have to get through a lot of quote-unquote action movie stuff in order to get to what the story is that they're telling.
Right.
There's a lot of silly stuff in this movie that shouldn't work. Like the Shake's character, who for some reason knows everything.
Right, he seems to have contacts everywhere, yeah.
Yeah, he's purely there as a scene-to-scene connective tissue. Even that funhouse fight is just so strange, because it starts with ninjas sliding down like a wacky slide, shooting machine guns.
Yeah,
nothing really.
That was one of the bits I'd forgotten about until I rewatched it. I was like, oh yeah, the slides where they come down on their knees.
Yeah, and even like, you know, at the beginning of the movie, after they have they can't remember the name of the character, the mob boss who's just getting out of trial.
Oh, the lieutenant guy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they've got a whole mass of reporters there who are asking him about the Punisher and about Frank Castle. So clearly this is someone who people know about. And he gets into his car and drives away, and the camera pans down, so you see this really ominous shot of the Punisher's boot with his awesome little skull knife in his boot before he follows them on a motorcycle. That means he should be in full view of everybody who was at the courthouse.
Right. Yeah.
You know, little stuff like that, like that later on.
Well, and considering that in the news report that we see at the start, you know, which gives us our little, here's how we're going to fill you in on everything that's happened so far. Mm-hmm. They name him, you know,
right.
Frank Castle and his family and their death is clearly a sort of, you know, was a newsworthy event. And then, yeah, as you say, he's not even wearing a disguise. He's just there on his bike.
Well, I mean, maybe he's hard to recognize because he's got kind of like a skull 5 o'clock shadow growing on his face, which is very odd choice. But
it's like Superman's glasses.
Right. And there's one other thing that always stuck out to me later is I think after he's been injured and he's recovering down in the sewer, he is listening to a speaker that is somehow tapped into wherever the mob bosses are talking to each other.
Right, to their base, yeah.
Right, and I mean, that's something that on first watch you don't really catch, but then you kind of go, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense.
How did he get that?
But, you know, so there's a lot of, you know, action movie stuff that's in there, which is great because it's a lot of fun. But I can see why that sheen of silliness would kind of stand out to people.
I guess. I think it depends whether you grew up with 80s action movies to an extent, because I did.
Oh, definitely,
you know,
yeah.
And so I am willing to forgive quite a lot, you know, of in that genre, because, yeah, there were certain things like that where you just didn't ask too many questions.
Right, right. Like, I mean, honestly, my friend Joe is going to hate me for saying this, but I think this has a better story than Cobra.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Cobra, there's about 15 minutes of story in that movie.
Yeah, Cobra's awful. Good Lord.
Yeah. It's great to look at, but I mean, there's nothing there.
Yeah, it's
but
very much a background movie.
Yeah, but this one is, I mean, unless you really enjoy watching Sylvester Stallone cut pizza with scissors, but which some people do. But this one, you know, there's a lot of meat on the bone here. It's just, it's you kind of have to, you know, weasel your way in and kind of find it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Speaking about the press as well, when they all rock up outside that lieutenant's mansion, And then the Punisher goes in and starts shooting people. Like, they just barge in. This is like, yeah. They all stood at the gate because, you know, private property and all that. And mm-hmm. as soon as they hear a gunshot, they just go, aha, and run to the house. Like, one, dangerous gunshot.
Oh, yeah.
And
yes.
two, I'm pretty sure that being shot, even in America, does not mean you suddenly lose your right to privacy.
As far as I know, no, but, you know, who knows? Stranger things have happened or could happen in the future.
It's just crazy. Yeah, again, just rushing in. But again, 80s movie, you know, you just kind of, action movie especially, you just go with it. It's necessary for them to get the shot of the Punisher standing in the flames and all that. Yeah, it's just nuts. And that's the first time that you see the sort of dead-eyed Frank Castle as well, that look of, you know,
oh, yeah.
nothing there, nothing to live for.
Oh, I love that first sequence when he takes out the guys in the house. I think it's really great. It's a nice introduction to the character, and you know, he's brutal, but he's mysterious, and I think right after that, the next scene is the underground naked praying scene.
Yes,
or the first of them, and it's just, man, you just really you're introduced to a weird character.
Yeah, well, and like I said, a not entirely sympathetic one either, which is
no.
Which I thought, yeah, was, you know, a sort of good and, you know, kind of brave move in a way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you look at all the other versions of the Punisher they've had, including, I believe, if I remember correctly, the most recent one from Daredevil, there's always a as bad as he is, there's always a sympathetic angle to him.
Yeah.
And yeah, in this one, they just really don't even try. And I think it's better for it, because I think I don't know if Dolph Lundgren really could have pulled it off as subtle as it probably would have needed to be. But yeah, they just treat him like he's almost more of a cartoon character. That's not the right way to say it.
Two-dimensional character.
Yeah. I was going to say he's almost more of a comic book character than the actual Punisher is, but I guess he's probably pretty accurate to the comic as far, because the Punisher in the comic is fairly unsympathetic.
Right. Well, and especially up until, as I say, the sort of Marvel Knights, Marvel Max relaunch and Ruckus
right.
version a few years ago. But yeah, certainly the Punisher of the 80s and 90s was a, you know, a very sort of unsympathetic character. And that's not to say that he wasn't popular, because, you know, vigilantes are generally popular with superhero readers, but he wasn't sympathetic, and there was no real attempt to make him sympathetic until the last sort of 15 years, really.
And yeah, I think that in the Thomas Jane version, that really stood out. They really went a long way to try and make him sympathetic, and I just didn't think it really worked. There's, you know, I don't know what it is about this character that it's hard to pin down. Much harder than it seems.
I think one of the things that they did get right here, and I don't think this is just me sort of projecting onto the movie, but when he has the sort of vision nightmare in his cell, not mm-hmm. under in the sewers, but when he's in police custody, and after Louis Gossett Jr. has tried to get through to him, failed, and says, well, you know, screw you then, and leaves him. And then he has like the sort of the nightmare and the visions, and you get the contra zoom and all that in his cell. It's kind of presented like he's going cold turkey.
Yeah.
From like the addiction of killing mobsters, you know? And like I said, I don't think that's me projecting. I think that was maybe intentional, because the way it's filmed is really the same way that you would film, yeah, a junkie going cold turkey or something. And that I thought was quite, just quite clever, quite perceptive.
Right. That's interesting. I never actually really thought about that before. But yeah, the, that, and the dream sequence is shot really interestingly too. Like for what they had to work with set wise,
yeah.
there's a really good nice shot of him driving through the sewer or something, where they've lit it with alternating lights that
yes.
create this really kind of multicolored strobe light tunnel kind of effect that he's driving through, and it's really cool.
It is, yeah. I mean, you can tell that they're clearly using the same stretch of corridor which is meant to be a sewer, but is way too big to be an actual sewer, but you know, whatever. But you can tell they're clearly using the same stretch of corridor over and over again for all of these shots. But yeah, they just light and dress it differently every time, and it works.
Right. And I think they do a really good job with what they have, because what stood out to me the most recent time that I watched it was how cool the end fight sequence in the dojo is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because again, you know, it's very comic booky, and I hate using that term, but I think it applies here because it actually is, like I said, everything in this movie is fairly accurate to a Punisher comic from the 80s. Like it feels like, one of those, Jorge Zaffino books or something. But you've got, you know, they come up the elevator and it opens onto these, samurai, which they just gun down, and then Shake sets off a charge that kills all the lights. But the emergency lights go on, so everything turns red. So you've got this really cool, heavy shadow, black and red fight sequence that goes on for a pretty good.
That's a good 10-15 minutes of the end of the movie. Yeah,
yeah, and it was a really good way to change things up and make things more visually interesting, in a way that to that point they haven't done. Like, there's nothing else in the movie that looks like that.
Right. Yeah, they don't. And this is actually something that a lot of 80s action movies did do, is use crazy lighting and neon mm-hmm. everywhere and stuff to make things look exotic. And they actually don't do that in most of this movie. But then, yeah, as you say, right at the end, suddenly everything goes red. And it does serve to give it almost a kind of otherworldly feeling. Like, okay, I mean, you know, putting sort of Eastern exoticism, fetishism aside, but it does give a sort of, okay, you're not in... this is not a regular thing, you know, this is something special, we've never been in this place, and it's going to be different now.
Right. Part of me wonders if maybe they did it so they wouldn't get an X rating, because they kill a lot of people in that sequence.
They do, that's true, yes.
So I was wondering if it was like a Kill Bill thing, where they go black and white so the blood doesn't show up as much.
Ah, right, because red lighting, yeah.
but, you know, that aside, it is a really interesting sequence, and it's... And the point at which the lights come back on is a really interesting point too. It's at the end of their kind of initial push, and you have that final standoff between Franco and Tanaka, who is threatening to kill Franco's kid, and it really kind of turning the regular lights back on, kind of brings everything back to focus a little bit,
yeah,
and really kind of locks you into this situation that's playing out here, this no-win situation, which ends with an awesome jump through a wall knife throw into the forehead,
right, which which is excellent, although if you look at the way she's holding the kid and the knife and then she falls forward, I'm pretty sure that would slit the kid's throat. But again, 80s action movie, yep. You just kind of ignore that.
Yep. Oh, well, man,
even modern action movies actually do that sort of thing a lot.
You want to get into that stuff. This movie suffers horribly from magic bullet disease.
Oh, yeah.
Where anything you hide behind, no matter how thin, is apparently bulletproof.
Right, unless it doesn't need to be.
Yes, yeah.
And then suddenly bullets will just rip through it. And cars blow up a fender bender. And
right. But, you know, there's also that great scene, the bus chase.
Yeah, that's good.
It's
yeah.
really good. And again, I think there's something in there that you kind of doesn't register now in modern through modern movie viewing eyes, because everything is so clearly, you know, stuntman and CGI and all this kind of stuff. There's a scene where the Punisher is driving a bus at full speed towards a carload of Yakuza guys, one of whom is standing on top of the car. So he's about level with the front of the bus, and then the bus hits the car, and the Yakuza guy gets launched into the bus through the front window of the bus. That was a real stunt.
Yeah. Well, you can tell it's a real stunt, yeah. Because in 1989, it had to be a real stunt.
Right. And that kind of thing, like, it doesn't register. It should register, but I feel like it doesn't register what actually just happened. But yeah, it's a guy, they drove a bus into a car and a guy jumped into the moving bus. And it's a pretty amazing stunt.
There are several like that, yeah, you're right. Because if you kind of realize, hang on, these are real stunts. There might be wires and stuff, but there's no CGI here because this is all, you know, this is pre those days by quite a few years. Yeah, it's quite remarkable. It's a bit like watching old Bond movies and seeing, you know, sort of the big stunts that they used to do in those, which again were real stunts.
Right, right. There's the famous one from, is it You Only Live and Let Die, where they do the car 360?
Oh, yes, the spinning, the rotating car over the ramps. Yeah, yeah.
Right, where they, I think they had to put something in there, or I've seen somewhere people talking about that because they hit it so perfectly that no one believed that it was actually done for real.
Right. Yeah, that does happen.
But, you know, I think we got into the end of it a little bit, and I want to talk about the ending because I love the ending of this movie. You have Franco's kid, Tommy, who is – I don't know if it's the actor or the way he looks or what it is. I think he is supposed to be written as capable. But he comes off as such a little twerp.
Yep.
And such a jerk. And he, like, there's a scene where he's imprisoned with all these other kids of the mobsters, where the kids are like, no, we're here because our dads are all rich mobsters. And he's like, my dad's not a rich mobster. And like, and they all go, dude, your dad is the biggest mobster. Yeah,
your dad's in charge.
Yeah. He's totally oblivious. And he just, that character just works. His hair looks stupid. He looks like a prep school kid who's completely oblivious to the world, and it works. So when you've got this ending here, where after they kill Tanaka, you've got Franco and the Punisher who earlier in the movie said, when this is over, I'm going to kill you. And Franco knows that the only guy left, he says it to him later on in the scene. He says, I have no more competition. The only person left in my way is you. So of course these guys got to go at it. And Tommy, the son, is a really interesting kind of third person in that scene because he's watching his father and the guy who just saved everybody, you know, fighting to the death. And he really doesn't know which side to fall on. So when the Punisher finally gets the upper hand and kills his father, he goes off and he grabs the gun and he's going to kill the Punisher. And it's like the Punisher drops to his knees, takes the barrel of the gun, puts it to his forehead, and says, do it.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Do it. And that's like, oh, my God. Could you imagine, like, any other action movie that ended that way with a kid about to kill the main character and the main character pretty legitimately hoping that he does?
Right, right. That's the thing. It's not an empty threat. It's like, yeah, you know, go ahead. You know, I won't regret it if you shoot me now.
Yeah, it's that, and it's also you know, as he kind of talks to after the scene, it's a little bit the Punisher just wants to die, but it's also a little bit Tommy kind of cementing his destiny sort of thing.
Right, don't grow up like your dad.
Right. Oh, and yeah, and when he takes the gun down, he has a great speech, which generally I would say, you know, you probably could have got away with him just leaving and not saying anything. But the thing he does say to the kid is so perfect.
You're a good boy, Tommy. Grow up to be a good man. Because if not, I'll be waiting.
Which, it's not watching, I'll be waiting.
Waiting, yeah, yeah.
Which is fantastic, and that's the last you see of the Punisher, and it's just, I don't know, I think this movie's great.
No, I agree. I absolutely agree. And, yeah, I mean, that last scene really cements the idea that this is kind of making the character more of a sort of Death Wish-style character than he is in the comics. Much, you know, in the comics, that's been explored more recently, but again, in the 80s and 90s version, there wasn't really much of that. But in this, they really take the idea that, yeah, he's been driven insane. And by the way, he's now sort of, he's, you know, he could look at this and say, yeah, I've completed my mission. So yeah, I can just die now.
Right. And he's kind of,
I mean, he obviously decides to carry on and he's going to be a scourge of the underworld and all that sort of thing. But he could legitimately look at, you know, the death of all these people and mainly Franco and say, yeah, okay, you know, job done.
Right, right. And I think in other versions of the Punisher, you kind of get that. Like, you kind of get to the end, and that's the natural conclusion to the Punisher's story is, you know, well, he kills the guy he needs to kill, and so then I guess he's done. But this one, they go out of their way to have one more scene with the Punisher praying naked in the sewer, where he, everything that has happened has not made him any less crazy.
Right. Yeah. He's just the same as he ever was.
Right. And it just cements him even further that his purpose is to kill everyone.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting take on it. 'Cause this, they have a similar scene at the end of the Thomas Jane one where it's kind of, it's really hacky and it's basically him being like, I'm here to help. I'm dun 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 the Punisher. And it's really hacky. And it's him basically on the superhero upswing at the end of the movie. But at the end of this movie,
no, this is a downswing.
No, there is nothing heroic about it. He's like, he's heroic in his own mind, maybe, but the stuff that he's saying and the point in the state of mind he's coming to is anything but.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're right. It's a great movie. And I would, I think it is available on DVD. I doubt it's available on streaming, but you never know. And I would encourage anyone who, especially if you did grow up watching 80s action movies and you've never seen this, then you will, I think you will enjoy this. If you are, you know, too young to have grown up watching 80s action movies, you know, maybe give it a try. I don't know. I think you do need to have that kind of, as we said, you need to be able to look past some of the tropes and trappings that that sort of, you know, decade of action movies had. But if you can do that, then there is a good movie, you know, sort of underneath all the cheap sets and cheap costumes and bad dialogue here. You know, there is a good movie if you can find it.
Oh, definitely. I think I don't know if how well this would land with a modern audience, to be honest with you. Like in a way that wasn't kind of jokey.
Right.
But if I were to pick a way ideally for someone to view this movie, if you're unfortunate to not have the access you did and see it in basically, you know, a grindhouse theater, this is the movie that you want to find on VHS by accident at your uncle's house.
Yeah.
And that you watch when nobody else is home. Like a gritty, grimy VHS tape that kind of probably skips in the middle and like the tracking is bad. That's the version you want to watch of this movie. But if you can't get your hands on that, it's also on YouTube. So.
Oh, is it? Right, the whole thing? Wow.
I believe so, yeah.
Not that we would ever encourage that.
No, never. No.
All right, Clay, thank you for coming on and talking to us about this. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is @deadmeatcomic. You can find me at my website, claytonmccormick.com. And if you like gritty action stuff, I have a online graphic novel that I've been doing that I've been kind of taking a break from lately, but there's 8 issues of comics and movies actually that you can watch to go with it over at eatdeadmeat.com.
Eatdeadmeat.com.
Yep.
How long have you been doing that for?
About 5 years. The last year or two, I haven't been doing it as much because I've been getting other work and I've been focusing on some other stuff. But I did it pretty much straight through for about, I'd say straight through for about 4 years, and then off and on for the fifth year. And then I've been trying to get back to it as I can, but it's getting tough.
Right. Yeah. Believe me, brother, I feel you there. Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. The work print thing, which was on YouTube also, that you sent me, I did get a chance to watch it, yeah. Do you know what it reminded me of, actually?
What's that?
Are you familiar with Escape from New York?
Oh, absolutely. My dog's name is Pliskin.
Really? Excellent.
Yep.
I genuinely love Escape from New York in the same way that I love this. I mean, more than I love this, but in the same way that it comes with all the caveats of being a low-budget 80s action movie.
Definitely.
But I absolutely love that movie. Have you seen the alternative intro?
Is it the one where he's like robbing a train, or he's just robbed something and he runs into the subway?
He robs a bank and escapes on the subway.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is what he gets arrested for and then taken to hawk outside New York penitentiary
right at the start.
But that's what I mean. It's the same kind of thing. It's basically much like this movie. Escape from New York starts in media res, and this missing 10-minute scene explains how we got there. And it's exactly the same thing in that it's only really of interest if you've already seen the movie.
Right.
And
right.
If you actually saw the movie for the first time with that at the start, you'd go, boring, get to the point.
Right. You know, I think when they do stuff like that, it really brings out something that I believe as far as characters go in stuff in movies and comics and anything, is that people always think that they want to know more about these characters,
right,
but it's not always important and it's not always beneficial. For instance, if you look at any of the Clint Eastwood, Sergio Leone movies, over the course of three movies, you learn absolutely nothing about that character.
Nothing at all, yeah.
Nothing. You don't even know his name.
And yet, but he endures as one of the most iconic characters in cinema history.
Right, because it's about his actions and it's about what he does in the moment that's important. If you look at Mad Max Fury Road, you don't learn anything about Max. You know, you don't learn anything about any of those characters. You learn how they, you learn who they are by their actions in the movie that you're watching. But, you know, if we had a 20-minute flashback of Max's family getting killed, that doesn't help you understand the movie any better.
Right. No, absolutely. It's good editing. I mean, that's the thing. It is good. It's a good choice and good editing that those movies don't have. You know, these 10-minute intro sequences at the start. You know, it is a good decision to leave them out. But you're right. Ardent fans will often say, oh, you know, they should have put this in. But actually, no. You know, if you'd seen this, if the first time you'd seen this movie, it had that 15 minutes of sub-lethal weapon stuff at the start.
Yeah.
You know, you would be going, oh my God, this is so dull.
Oh, it's real boring. It's real boring.
It really
is. Even when they get to that action sequence at the beginning, it's just, it's so stiff and
it's nowhere near it. It's not ninjas in a fairground, is it? Let's face it. Did you read my series, Codename Babushka, that came out?
No, I haven't.
Earlier this year. Oh, okay. My confession is that I named one of her rogues gallery, a Japanese Yakuza boss, Tanaka.
Nice.
I called him Tanaka-san, and it is, I confess, it is a direct reference to this movie.
Don't be ashamed. More references to this movie need to happen.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to get it.
Louis Gossett Jr. just drives it home. I believe everything he says about when they're in the sewer and she's asking him why you don't give up. And he says, well, because I know what it's like to be given up on. That speech should be pretty hacky, but I buy it 100%.
Right. As soon as I heard that, I was like, oh God, here we go. It's the old ex-alcoholic thing. But yeah, he sells it. He is so good.
Yeah. And all of that follows him into that scene when they're in the prison together. And it's just, I don't know. I think he's definitely the through line to the movie that really pulls it all together. I don't know if you've seen the documentary Cocaine Cowboys.
No.
It's really good. It's a really interesting documentary about the drug wars in Miami in the 80s. And the kingpin, well, the queenpin, if you will, of the entire thing was this woman named Giselle DeBlanco, mm-hmm. who is basically everybody who talks about her as the most evil human being on the planet. Like they go into all the horrible stuff she did. And basically it's like that scene where Franco is telling all of his lieutenants about Tanaka and about how bad she is.
Oh yeah.
And it made me wonder if maybe they had based the character on this Giselle DeBlanco woman. But if you get a chance, if you're interested in that stuff at all, check it out. It's a very intense documentary.